Kicking us off tonight, the only band that you're going to be hearing any music from tonight, that was Paranoid Visions with Missing in Action from 40 Shades of Gangrene, the first album they released, the first studio album they released since they reformed back in 2005. And that, Missing in Action, was the first song. So we'll still be here until 11:30 tonight, but we'll be giving the whole show over to Paranoid Visions, and the majority of that is going to be taken up with an interview that we done last week. And we have a couple of exciting singles to play for you, and also a specially recorded session that the band kindly done for the show. If you're one of our regular texters, by all means text in. I'll get to the text next week, and I will be knocking around the show, but as this is a pre-recorded show, I'll only be coming in and out, and so I won't really have time to get to texts tonight. Okay, so for all those of you who don't know, Paranoid Visions originally formed in 1981. The current lineup is Deco on vocals, PA System on guitar, Aoife Destruction and Sarah Bellum also on vocals, Politician on drums, and Kevin Seven on guitar. Also Steve Vision on samples, and the most recent member is Chris Burke on bass, and he recently replaced Cormac the Master Switch, who has moved to San Francisco. I believe Chris is still a member of Job Seekers. They initially broke up in 1992, although not officially. Deco went on to form Strict 90C, and he was with that band for most of the 90s and early 2000s. They first got back together in 1996 to support the Sex Pistols on a couple of dates, and then again in 2001 to support the Damned on their 25th anniversary gig in Dublin. In 2005, they got back together with the intention of playing a couple of shows to mark the release of Outside In, The Vinyl Years, which is a compilation of all the stuff that was only available on vinyl. And they had so much fun that they decided to stay together. Since then, they've released 3 studio albums, a whole host of EPs and singles. Most recently, Outsider Artists, which featured a collaboration with TV Smith and also The Shend, and a band from New York called The Blame. Next week sees the release of an Irish-only EP, Poles Apart, and then a little later in the year, in September, they released their new studio album, the 4th studio album since 2005, Escape from the Austerity Complex. And they're also going to release a special single for John Robb's Louder Than War label, and we talk about that through the interview. The fact that they've released 4 studio albums and so much other material in the last couple of years, that's where we kick off. The first question I put to Peter is what he attributes this bout of productivity to.
We've always been very prolific, you know. Like Deco as a lyricist is ridiculous as in the amount of words and stuff that he writes. It really is. It's just incredible. We'd never manage to keep up with that. For every one song that we do, there's about 7 or 8 that aren't done, you know. So we've always been prolific with that. It's easier these days. See, since we reformed, it's a lot easier to make a record than it used to be. So once you've kind of got into the flow of how to do it and having the infrastructure to be able to do it, then it's a lot easier to write a bundle of songs, record the bundle of songs, and off you go. As a band, we don't take any money out of anything that we do. If we do a gig and we make money, we take nothing out of it. We get royalties, or we get iTunes royalties, or we get Imro royalties, or we get, you know, CD sale royalties. We take zero out of it. Every penny that we make, every penny that we get, gets recycled straight back into doing something else. So that makes it a lot easier to be prolific with the stuff that you're actually writing. There's no game plan that you're actually writing something and then, you know, you're fantastic, we sell 200 copies and we've made a couple of quid and everyone takes a couple of quid and that's all brilliant, we're all delighted with it. And then we go, we've another 12 songs, what we do? So, how are we going to finance recording it? So that is a huge help. That's a huge benefit to be able to actually get it done. We're also fortunate in that if we release something, people do buy it. So it means that they're self-financing regardless. You know, we put the money up for the pressing, we get it back relatively quickly. And recently, over the past year, certainly for the new album mainly, we bought initially an 8-track or a 12-track Porter Studio. And we did a lot of recording on that. And then we exported that in the studio into Pro Tools and we mixed it and added to it in there. It meant that we were getting away with doing maybe a day in the studio at whatever, 200 or 300 quid, whatever it is, a day in the studio. We're getting away with paying that for one day, and out of that we'd have the equivalent of maybe 2 weeks recording, you know, because we'd have recorded the track, and one of the tracks on the album, Don't Let the Rot Set In, we recorded that 5 separate times for the album. You know, we just kept re-recording it and re-recording it. Every time we would fine-tune it a little bit when we were doing it live, and we'd say, that was a really good ending. We'd go, right, let's go back in and record it again. Yeah. Much better version. I was just listening today, the album version of it is 6 minutes and whatever, 15 seconds long, something like that. And we were looking for tracks for the B-side of the Poles Apart single. And I thought I'd go through some of the demo tracks and the earlier versions and things like that, you know, maybe pad it out with a load of this stuff. And the version of Don't Let the Rot Set In, the first recording of it, was there. Mm-hmm. And it's 4 minutes 20 seconds long. So we've actually added on nearly 2 minutes of it. Maybe we shouldn't keep doing that, you know what I mean? We should stick with it. The one track that we recorded with Chris for the album, it's 54 seconds long. I reckon if we just kept gigging it, we'd end up with a thing about an hour. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the reason why we've been very active. It's because we can. It's
so much easier.
Well, we can. We can do it.
Well, just mentioning like new software and stuff like Pro Tools and kind of how it facilitates being able to record prolifically. This is another example of an album where you're kind of revamping older material. On the last couple of studio albums, there's been like older tracks that have been kind of updated, or you've appropriated new technology to do newer versions of them. Is that because that maybe this technology that you're talking about that allows you to be more prolific, allows you to be more experimental in ways that you couldn't do in the past as well?
Well, I mean, on Gangrene, we redid Visions. Now, obviously, 40 Shades of Gangrene was the first album that we did, you know, in so many years. So there would have always been a few songs that we would have been hanging around prior to throwing in the towel. So most of those ended up in it. But we re-recorded Visions for that album because the version of it on Schizophrenia was terrible. Now, no one else can really tell how bad it is, but I know how bad it is because there's timing things, there's mistakes all over the place on it that you couldn't fix, you know, 20 odd years ago. So that's why we re-recorded that, because we had a much better version to do. Likewise on Beware of the God, out of old tracks, I think there's only
Asylum in My Mind.
Asylum in My Mind, yeah, well done, Chris. Asylum in My Mind, because it was a good song, and we just did it in the rehearsal room for a bit of a laugh, and we thought, yeah, we'll have a go at that, we can do a better version. From Dublin With Love was another one that we did an awful lot of rewrite on it. I don't know if there's any other really old ones on that one.
Yeah, it's not that there's an abundance of them, but
there's always something there. Yeah. I mean, like, on the new album, Politician Is On, again, now the reason, I mean, that was out on an EP, the reason why it was out on the EP was because our friend Psycho had died, and that was his favourite song of all time. It was played at his funeral, and then when there was an election coming up, we thought, you know, this has got to be a tribute to him, so we re-recorded a new version of it and we put that out. But the thing is, it is a good song and it's a great recording of it, but that single was only released in Ireland. Now the album's going out everywhere, so we wanted to put it on the album, and like, I was conscious of the fact that some people might go, When the album started out, it was like a 10 or a 12 track album, and got 3 of the tracks have already been out. Should we leave all systems go off? No, we shouldn't leave them off, because they're good, they're relevant, and they haven't been heard anywhere else. They haven't been heard outside of Ireland, except for at live gigs and whatever, or CDs bought at gigs. And then the other one that's taken off, that's also an old one redone on this album, is Statement of Intent. That was on our second demo. Now, the only thing that links what was on the second demo with the thing that we've just done is it's a looping bass line. It's the same. It's a repetition. It's almost like it could almost be a tape loop. There's that on the title. Other than that, it's a totally different song. But that was one of those things when you kind of thinking back on old songs and stuff that you'd really, really liked that you did in the early 80s or whatever, you know, things that really stuck in the mind. but never haven't been heard by people, hardly, and weren't that great recordings. Mm. They weren't great recordings, they weren't great versions, they weren't particularly brilliantly thought out. We figured we'd just have another go of that, and we did it. We've done a really, really powerful version of that, I think.
I didn't necessarily mean, you know, what it was. I was kind of harking back to something that you said a couple of years ago when you talked about how you got your kind of own kind of idiosyncratic style was from trying to play, like, bands, and then maybe I thought maybe that was always in the back of your mind when earlier versions of songs just, you know, you weren't content with how a recorded version.
Yeah, no, you are right. I mean, if we think back, you know, going through the evolution of the band without going into it too much, the original, the first ever lineup of the band, what we wanted to sound like is what we sound like now, but we weren't good enough to be able to pull it off. And then the second lineup of the band was a completely different thing altogether. It wasn't particularly how myself and Deco really wanted it to sound. You know, it was good for what it was, but what we wanted to sound like was the way we sounded on our first ever demo and the kind of music we were doing. So the various evolutions as we're going on, since we reformed in 2005 or 2006, it's gradually got closer and closer to being exactly what we always thought we should sound like. I think now, what we've got now, the actual lineup that we have now, has finally 100% nailed it. It's exactly the way that we always wanted it to sound. We were nearly there with the earlier, before Chris joined, we were nearly there. You know, in fact, I would have actually said, yeah, we were there. But it's just, you know, Chris has got a real bounce off the playing. And it's got, the potential is there for us to actually not so much just sound the song sounding exactly the way that we want them to sound now, but the potential is there to write some of the songs that we've always wanted to write and not been able to actually do.
Chris, I might bring you in there if you don't mind answering the question about how you came to be in the lineup.
Well, since I started going to gigs, I was normally part of the business. Like, I've seen them loads of times. Like, I was more than needing a bassist, and I'd recently started playing again with Job Seekers. But after that, I hadn't been playing in about a year. A whole part they were looking for a bassist, and I jumped on the chance. Like, that'd be great, correctly.
Okay, yeah. So you were a huge fan before joining the band, because I know you haven't quite as many lineups as maybe somebody like The Fall or something like that.
Yeah.
He has a strict rule about, you know, not hiring fans of the band. Like, so you fall into the category of being an avid fan prior to joining.
I was a fan before I joined, but I liked the music just as well. I liked some totally old music, but I liked playing. Like,
and that was Outsider Artist, which, as I mentioned earlier on, features TV Smith. And just in case there was I wasn't a bit clear, the track featuring The Shend isn't that one. It's on the B side also. It's Control, It's Lovely Today, and one from the New York band The Blame is Blame It On The Visions, and that's also on the B side. Also on that EP there's a kind of a live album. There's about nine, I think there's nine tracks, so it's well worth getting hold of. Okay, so speaking there as well with Peter was, I suppose, obviously Chris Burke, the newest member of the band. And we go on to talk about how the group recruit new members.
The way we've always operated, and as you said, there's been an awful lot of band members, but then again, we've been around for an awful long time, so that's why there's an awful lot of band members. We very, very, very rarely have ever auditioned anyone for the band. It's usually people are chosen not so much because of their ability, it's because they're going to fit in. So Sarah joined because Deco knew her and she'd been to a couple of gigs and she was really cool and, you know, she's just a really nice girl and she really fitted in with us personally. And as it turned out, she could sing. Now, so that was great. In she comes. Paul Paul was Beano standing while Beano was going on holidays to Germany. That was 2007. Right, so, you know, Paul was just inducted. He didn't even know he was joining the band. Joe, in 1990, where it probably would have been, Joe was asked, would he just play a little bit of extra guitar on a track we were recording? And he's never left since. Even when he's not in the band, he's in the band. And Kev was his cousin. He joined in as the bass player when we reformed, because he seemed like he was the right person. Just, we hadn't even heard him play. Kev wandered in the room clutching somebody else's bass into the rehearsal room the first day, and he wanders in and I said, are you Kev? And he goes, yeah. He says, how's it going? There's an amp over there. Come on, let's go. And that was it. Kev thought he was auditioning. We're playing in Amsterdam in 5 weeks. It's going to be brilliant. Are you ready? He's like, fuck is this? And then Aoife is the same. Aoife, I've known Aoife for years. When we were doing Treasure on the Wasteland, we reckoned we needed some more voices for the Oyoyes. And she just lives down the road from here. And she said to me before, I can sing. And I said, hey, Sarah couldn't come in for some reason on that night. So we really wanted to put an extra voice down. I said, Aoife, will you nip up and stick down a bit of vocally thing on this? You know, so she came up and it was the biggest revelation ever. John, right? We'll see if we can auto-tune her and get her in. And this voice came out and went, Jesus, that's fantastic. And she's never officially joined either. She just hasn't gone away. You know? So, okay, Chris was the first person who came down to actually play. We had a load of people were interested. A few people were saying, yeah, well, we'll bring you down or whatever. And he came in and we said, oh, geez. We said in advance, if Chris can play, we're all right. We'll just leave it at that. You know, won't bother with anybody else.
In the spirit of that kind of attitude for getting new band members, do songs still kind of stem from yourself and Deco, and then everybody else is brought in?
Not as much. It used to be like that constantly, and it was like that for years and years and years and years. You know, we need a new song, and everyone would turn around and stare at me. Can I give one? Now it's expanding quite a lot. I mean, there's two or three, there's certainly two tracks, I think, on the album that Kev wrote. There's a piece that Joe did on his own completely with Deco. Aoife stuck a 10 pence worth in on a couple. Sarah stuck a 10 pence worth in on a couple. Cormac wrote one. Wrote one and a half anyway, maybe two. And the rest of them are pretty much mine and Deco's. But certainly everybody's sticking more in. And I think moving forward, we might... I think most stuff will be very collaborative. I mean, Chris had been in... How long had you been in the band? How many rehearsals before we recorded a new song?
Three.
We wrote a new song with Chris. It's an overall... There's no two ways about it. It's everybody who was in the room did it. And then Paul stuck down some drum tracks and gave a drum track to Chris, who wrote a song to go with it that is now coming over to me for me to do some stuff on as well. So I think, you know, we're going to be an awful lot more collaborative.
And would you have always preferred it to be like that, or is it just now that you're ready for it to be like that?
No, I've always preferred to be like that. But it's like as you were saying, the questions you were asking Chris about, you know, what's it like coming in and everything's a tight little. We've never seen it that way, you know. And it's only when you hear someone else saying, you go, yeah, actually, you've got a point. it might seem that way when you come in, you know. I've got a song. Well, no, don't. You know, it's not like that. It should always be like that. But the reason why it's never been like that maybe is because people were terrified at the idea of saying we've got a song. You know,
just on why we're talking about this being, you know, more of a collaborative effort. There's a lot of collaborations outside of the band on this album.
Yeah.
How did that come to pass? Is that a key thing that you always wanted to do and now you find yourself in a position to do it?
No. It's the kind of things that you dream of but never actually believe is going to happen. It's just, it's, you know, like that Wayne's World movie, you know, book them and they will play. We knew Tim, you knew TV Smith from Rebellion and stuff like that, and from having him on at the Steve Ignorant gig or whatever. And he was coming over for a gig we were putting on, and I just rang him and said, listen, Tim, we're doing a, recorded this new song, and do you fancy doing something on it? And he goes, I'll send it over to me. I sent it over to him by email, and he goes, I love it, brilliant. Yeah, I'll do it, yeah. Right, TB Smith is on one of our records. And then the same, then I was chatting with John from Overground, who's our label putting it out, chatting with him, and saying, brilliant, the TB Smith's on one of the songs, you know. He says, you know, why don't you ask the Shend? He's a huge fan. He absolutely loves you. It'd be great having him on something. Shen, do you fancy doing a vocal on it? I'd love to! Fine, right? So then you go for the top end of the heap, right? And I ring Steve Ignorant and said, we're doing this song, Split Personality, and I swear we cannot manage to get the vocal time. We can't get it the way we want to sound it. And the only way I can describe what we want is we need a Steve Ignorant delivery on it. And you know, and he goes, do you want me to come over and do it? Yeah. So when he's on the way over to do that song, we decided we would drop it on him when he reached Dublin. Would you like to do two songs?
Yeah. So he's up for it.
And he goes in the car. In the car, and he goes. Says you'll know it. Says you'll know it. You know, we have another song. You know that we recorded before, Rock and Roll Revolution. We did this years back, you know, and the first verse of it was Crass as Punk is Dead, and he goes, I know the song, you cheeky bastards. I said, yeah, well, we've rewritten the verse of it, and we want to do this as a single for Louder Than War, because the single coming out on them, we want to do a single for Louder Than War, and they want an exclusive track, and we want the exclusive track to be with you, but we also want you on the album, so would you consider doing this one as well? And he goes, stick it on. And we played it on the M50. I'm playing the original version of it. And he's listening to it. And he had the lyrics. And he goes, right, put it on again. We put it on again. And he starts singing along in my car. And going, this is just absolutely bizarre. I mean, say I'm a Crass fan is an understatement, right? Yeah. And so we went to Paul's house and recorded two songs in an hour and 15 minutes. And off we go. And that's coming out on a 7-inch single in Ireland the same day that the album's coming out. It's coming out in England on the same day, but the album's coming out in the UK and Europe 2 weeks after.
On the programme today, punk. What is it? What does it stand for?
And then, some time later, the same question was asked in a slightly different form. They were asked,
and what happened to Crass?
Someone told me punk was dead, I couldn't believe what the fucker said. But I'm only gonna spite my hair, just inside his what to wear. I was at the show them all, the circle that's made on the walls. Revolution in my hair, anarchy was fucking dead.
We don't need this revolution!
Before the break, we had Rock and Roll and Revolution, the Steve Ignorant Paranoid Visions single that's going to be released on John Robb's Louder Than War label, at the same time as the new album, Escape from the Austerity Complex, is going to be released here in Ireland. We also have plenty of more stuff to come. The new single, Pulls Apart, and also the two tracks that the band recorded, especially for the show. When we get back to the interview with Peter, we're still talking about the single that's going to be released on Louder Than War.
They're all limited editions. And they're only one pressing. That's the guarantee. It's one pressing only. But the, I think with Steve being like, he's more than just prominent on it. You know what I mean? He's the lead vocalist on it. And it's the first thing he's done in 16, 17 years. And it's way better than Schwarzenegger or Stratford's. You know, yeah. This is going, to me, it sounds like the Buzzcocks playing a cover version of a song off the second Crass album, you know, it's it, or vice versa, Crass doing a cover version of a Buzzcocks song, maybe. So I think it could do really well. So they're saying, well, to cover ourselves, we might do an initial pressing of 1,000, and that's it.
Well, I suppose there's problems as well with distribution. If it, there's only if it's limited to 500, and then it's like, you know, Steve's fan base in the UK trying to get a hold of it, and then well, not that there's not.
I think it's more so. Oh, Jesus, yeah. we're not even a halfway place beside him, but I think, you know, around the States and Asia and parts of Europe and stuff, that's probably where it'll sell off a lot more. It'll be out on download anyway as well.
And that single came to pass from what John Robb being a fan of the band, a friend of the band.
Yeah, well, yeah. John's always been. I mean, we've known John for years, but he's always been really into us. But he had mentioned this Louder Than War thing to me, and I said, "Yeah, yeah, we'd love to do something." And nothing more came to pass. And then, because Alison from Southern manages Steve Ignorant, I had to, even though I went straight to Steve about it, he said, look, have a word with Alison and just sort out how we're dealing with it. And when I rang her about it, I said, look, I know that he's obviously way bigger than us and I don't want you to feel that we're exploiting him. So I want to give you the option, because downloads last forever, I want to give you the option, do you want to release it? Do you want to release it on Southern? Even as a download track, I don't mind taking it off the album. But release it on Southern if you want, so you can control and Steve can get some royalties and whatever else. And you know, we'll never rip you off, but 25 years time, we might lose our phone number, you know. So, and she said, sounds brilliant, sounds really keen, yeah, let me get back to you. And then she rang me back and says, look, John Robb's here at the moment doing the new Goldblade album. And when I mentioned it to him, he nearly hit the ground. He said, whatever, at all costs, we have got to do this. We have got to release this on Louder Than War. And then John rang me and said, I want to be on the single as well. We said, well, I don't think we can really do John Robb and Steve Ignorant on one song, right? So we did, Steve is on Split Personality on the album. We did a different version of Split Personality for the single, with John Robb singing one verse, Sarah singing one verse, Deco singing one verse. So that's the B-side of the single. So John's got his. He's on a single with us as well. He's happy with that.
Excellent.
So,
considering he's going to be at Rebellion, has there any plans to do anything with him there?
Well, with John? No. Probably not. No, probably not, because we won't be doing Split Personality on the set. But TV Smith, I'm hoping we're going to have a word with Tim and he might get up and do Outsider Artist. Steve was talking about going. And if he goes, then he'll do Rock and Roll Revolution with us. Unless, if he tells me soon, he's definitely going, we might rehearse Split Personality. But I'd be less happy trying to do that as a first take, first time playing it live in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people with him and us making an absolute bags of it.
Just how did they, all those friendships blossom? Was it quite recently? Not even, you knew that, I know you played with the Membranes back in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Steve Ignorant and the Shen thing, was that was all quite recent, was it?
Mm. Shen we got very friendly with, because see, sometimes it we don't think people know who the hell we are, and it amazed me that the Shen, I mean, you know, me and Deco, huge fans of the Gravats, free copies of Gravats and Toy Town was actually owned by people in Ireland, and all three of them were in Paranoid Visions, right? Huge fan. And I couldn't wait to meet the Shand. And then I was told by the label that he actually had albums of ours and he really loved us. Oh God, that's just bizarre. Tim didn't know us, but when I contacted him about coming over to play the Steve Ignorant gig in Dublin, he researched us and came back to me and said, I've only heard 6 tracks of yours, which I managed to find on the internet. I really want to have some more. So I gave him all the albums, and he's a celebrity friend. And now, I mean, the latest one is, which again is another really strange one for me, is Zilla Minx from Rubella Ballet. She's done a vocal on the intro for Poles Apart. And her and Sid, the drummer at Rubella Ballet, who drummed in Flux Pink Indians and X-Ray Specs. He's mastering the album for us. And it turns out that the two of them have been fans of ours since the early 80s. Now, given that I bought their first release, which is Ballet Bag on cassette, from Richard out of Poison Girls, on advance order on the first 100 of that ever manufactured, and I was a huge fan of Rubella Valley when I was only a kid. That's just really strange. So you know, these people tend to know who we are. We've been around long enough, and the Rebellion Festival is a big help.
Yeah,
because there's a community of bands who are there that we get to know really well now, and pick up the phone and ring most of them and stuff like that. Just yeah.
Picture this. A blue planet protected by a thin layer of atmosphere. It keeps temperature, air, water, and a perfect balance to maintain life. In the cold depths of space, this planet is a virtual paradise, the only one known of its kind. It is our planet, Earth.
After being a fan for so long, you should never really be surprised, I suppose, by what the band do. But that sounds really different, I suppose, to anything that they've done, and really incredible. That is the new single, Pulls Apart, which features Zilla Minx from Rubella Ballet. And that's going to be available as an Irish-only release from next weekend. Since re-establishing FOAD, FOAD Music, the punk rock label owned by the band, they have put out an album, several albums, in fact, compilation albums, an album by Sitting Off Sirens, and they're going to be putting out the Job Seekers next album, and also previous guests, the Lee Harveys. Because of the work involved, putting on the amount of gigs they do and stuff as well, I asked Peter, what was the motivation for doing it?
I have no clue.
No one else will.
Well, no one else would do it, that's the thing, yeah. There's a big myth about how difficult it is to make a record. The other thing is, it is so easy to do it that a lot of people who are making records shouldn't be making records. So the quality control out there in the marketplace, if a band is completely self-released, sometimes people are kind of not so much holding it at arm's length, but there's no reference point. If we put it out, or if we put on a gig and put a band on a gig, straight away there's a kind of QC thing there, and that's kind of what happens. So automatically, you know, I mean, the Lee Harveys have done a couple of gigs and they couldn't get anyone going at the gigs until we started throwing them on gigs, and as soon as we put them on and people saw them, people go, Jesus, these are brilliant, this is absolutely fantastic. And they're picking up a lot of recognition now as well. I suppose, I mean, that's probably the nearest thing to the motivation. To be honest, it's seeing a band that you know could possibly throw in the towel, having done one gig or two gigs and not recorded anything, and falling by the wayside, like a load of bands that we saw when we were kids, when we were younger. Loads of really, really talented bands who never released anything, have been totally ignored by the annals of rock history in Ireland. And it shouldn't have been, but there was no outlet, there was no one to kind of pull it together, no one to kind of say, look, come in and we'll do it. Like in England, they had John Peel, who would take all the underground, and here for a while we had Dave Fanning, who would do it. If Dave Fanning played it, the QC or somebody went up there and you'd immediately start having a look at who this band was. So I suppose, I mean, that's probably the motivation. It's certainly not money, because we don't make anything out of it. Provided we don't lose anything out of it, that's the main thing. The main reason is almost certainly it's just to try and create more of a document and just to be there, part of it, you know.
Obviously, bands would have their own goals and their own reasons for making music in the first place. How receptive are some of the younger bands to any kind of advice you're giving? Or do you get involved in the aspect of it at all?
Yeah. No, not really. I think I've given advice to one band, and I don't think they bothered taking it up. They split up. I tell a lie. One who did take notice, Mongo Horn. Okay. Eddie will probably deny it, but Mongo Horn, they had about half their set with cover versions, and they were brilliant cover versions. But they started off the set with the cover versions and then started throwing in their own songs. And I just thought, shit, I really thought I knew everything about punk rock. I don't recognise that song. last one was Circle Jerks, that one was Black Flag. And what was the one in the middle? Oh, that was Our Own. Fuck the cover versions, lads. Do your own. We're only seven songs. We'll only do seven songs. Do seven songs, two cover versions. Gone, finished, out in 25 minutes. That's what Black Flag would have done.
Yeah. Aside from having your own record label and putting out records by their bands, surely the workload that you're bringing upon yourselves for putting on these gigs and stuff like that, does it infringe on Paranoid Visions at all? Are you just able to kind of work it all?
Yeah, it doesn't infringe on what Paranoid Visions do. It interrupts Peter at home with Aideen and the kids, but needs have the devil must. when she listens to this, she'll be shouting at the fucking radio. But I mean, Deco does some, looks after some of the run some of the gigs as well. The gigs now run themselves. You know, we have it down to a little fine art. Design the poster. I'll do that when I have a chance. I design the posters sometimes 4 months in advance. You know, so we're not like panicking. It's done. It's waiting. It's sitting on email. We're ready to print out 2 or 3 weeks in advance. Deco puts them up, so that, you know, it's not a problem. The Sweeney's gigs are dead handy. They've already got a back line. I don't have to worry about getting the back line down. Don't have to worry about people doing the door and stuff. You know, it's not nearly as hard a work as it seems, because I've already got the venue booked. And the venue's all booked. The hardest thing is filling in four bands. Mm-hmm. But again, I work so far in advance. It's not a major deal, you know?
There's not even difficulty. I've been just living in Dublin the last year. The amount of bands I've seen I thought I'd never, would never have seen. I mean, even that element of it isn't, you know, is that not kind of... I imagine there's a lot of back and forth and trying to... Because one of the things as well is that, you know, the cost is always kept down, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously... there's a bit of negotiation there between bands that are coming over as well.
Yeah. I mean, the bands that are coming over, it's usually easy enough. They'll either come for what they're being offered or they won't. It's as simple as that. We tend to do an awful lot of bands who aren't touring bands, who are coming over for a one-off, because we offer them the option, usually, you know, I mean, a lot of the gigs we put on like that with touring bands or with travelling bands, vanity gigs. We want to play with Zounds, so we're going to bring Zounds over. You know, that's the kind of thing that happens. But if we're playing on the bill, we say to them, look, get over here, the cheapest flight you can get over. Don't even bring instruments. We have a suite of Gibsons and Rickenbackers and Fenders, and we'll give you a choice of guitars, play our stuff, and just come over, do the gig, put you upstairs in Fibbers, relatively cheap to do it. A few quid for the gig, whatever it is they're looking for, and the crowds are always there for it. And if at the end of it we make nothing at all, then so be it. We make nothing. If we make some money out of it, then great. But if we don't make the money, you know,
got to put the gig on.
Yeah, well, it's a brilliant night out. We've had a great evening. By and large, I mean, most of the bands aren't particularly greedy. It gets greedier, funnily enough, if they want 2 or 3 gigs, because then they want to come over in a van. And they want to do this, this, and this, and suddenly their costs are now maybe £1,200 to come over and do the gigs. You bring Zounds over. Zounds came over on the car ferry, and they came over as foot passengers. You know, they drove to Liverpool or whatever, and they came over on the ferry, and I picked them up. I think their costs, if they were £150, it'd be surprising. And we paid them a decent few quid and put them up in Fibbers, and they thought it was fantastic. Yeah. They were delighted. They're easy enough to negotiate, and again, they're a lot less hassle if it's all being controlled as a coming in for one gig and off you're going again. Then there's no worry of how are you getting to Belfast, how are you getting to Tullamore, how are you getting to Cork, are they going to let me down up in Belfast or Cork, is it going to sour the entire thing when the gig that they go to at Sligo has got 20 people at it and everyone's pissed off. So I much prefer controlling it myself. They come in on Saturday, do the gig, go home Sunday. Everyone has a great time. They go home with hangovers and they have a fabulous evening.
first of two tracks that the band recorded especially for the show. That track was On the Run from the forthcoming album Escape from the Austerity Complex. We next moved downstairs in the band's rehearsal room to speak to the rest of the band, primarily Deco. And the first question that I put to Deco, Peter having mentioned what a prolific songwriter he was, I asked him, I guess, did he agree, and what motivates him to write?
Yeah, because I've nothing else to do. I write all the time. Like, basically, even if we don't use it, I have bags and bags. Same with when I was in Strychnine DC. It was like I had hundreds of lyrics that never got used then, and I still have them. But I write fairly regularly, really. I send it to him over the phone quite regularly as well. I just text it, you know, because I don't know why, but I just, pretty prolific. I shout at the news every night. I shout at the radio in the morning when I'm going into work. Well, I don't be going to work, but when my board's going to work, I shout at the radio. I got really angry. I don't know why. It's just Irish society makes me either put it down or else I'll be arrested. So I have to actually get it out somehow. And the band isn't prolific. We're like when I was in Strychnine, we had 100 songs in 6 months. I had that much stuff written, and we had the band was that we were rehearsing every day, whereas this band we rehearse less, but we still got a fair volume of stuff out. I'm just angry, and I have to put it down to stop myself taking it out on the passerby or, you know, the people on the street.
Does how you write for Paranoid Visions differ from how you wrote for Strychnine DC, or could one of the songs be used for Paranoid Visions in the same way that it could have been used for Strychnine DC?
Well, yeah, basically because I write to a formula that I variate to fit the type of music. But we're prolific now, whereas a few years ago we weren't writing as fast, and so I was building up, but we're writing fairly fast now. But I write the same way as I always did, and then I'll adapt it to the music. I'll leave out, there's quite a lot of stuff that I've written that I've had to whittle down to fit it into the song. And then there's other songs where I could write, you know what I mean? I basically do 32 lines, and if the song is a long one, they'll fit. If it's a short one, it goes down to 8 or to 16.
How do you bring it to the band then? Is it a case of there's a couple of like songs knocking around, and then you just think that these lyrics will suit that, or is it you give them the lyrics and then you kind of knock something around?
They come up with a riff. If there's a riff going down here, I'll hear something in it, and I'll have books, I have a bag of stuff over there. That's full of current stuff. I've got my flat is like a junk shop. It's just full of records and lyrics. But I'll hear when they're playing something. I'll hear it, and then I'll find a set of lyrics that fit it and a vocal that fits. And then, now sometimes they'll come up with a thing that I've never heard before, like the track for the opening on the album, Austerity Crusade. I wrote that when they presented me with the music. I just wrote the vocal on it, and then I adapt. I can do it that way either. So if we're hearing I've no lyrics, I'll write a lyric there and then in my head, and I'll basically know what it's about, go home, write it, finish it, and then bring it in, finish. I never wrote about relationships. I don't write about personal things because that's a bit sore, and I've never gone through them anyway. I've never been in love. I've never gave a fuck. So like about personal things, I think that's for boy bands and broken-hearted teenagers. And I don't mind it. It's grand if they want to sing about it. It's not something I wouldn't, you know, it would never have entered my head to write about that. I don't open up myself. So I don't write about anything personal. I write about the way I look at the world, but not my own. I don't write woe is me, or, you know, I don't write about boy-girl things because they're old.
There's real similarities between what you were writing 30 years ago and what you're writing now. Do you think that you just came fully formed as a lyricist?
Well, what I did was, when I started getting into punk, the bands that really influenced me were the ones with the lyrical, you know, the the ones with really intelligent protest lyrics. The protest, I got into punk through the protest and then the music. But when I, the bands I used to listen to back then, well, I really got into punk when the likes of, what you call it, Crass and Discharge and all that. I was getting into it before that with the adverts, the lyrical side of things, but never, like, it was more the protest punk bands that I started thinking, geez, I can do that, you know, and I feel the same way as they do. Well, I don't want it to sound like secondhand Discharge or secondhand Crass. I've got to write it my way, and I'm still writing the same stuff. I still see the world through the same eyes. Like, I haven't changed my circumstances. Now, willingly, it's my own choice. I haven't gone out. I left the streets. I'm on the street every single day of the week. I see what's going on around me every day of the week. I walk the streets with the junkies and the homos and the hobos. I mean, nothing gets so. I walk those streets every day. I'm down in the doll queues. Like, I've been there all my life, and so my lyrics wouldn't really have changed that much. They're getting harder. They're getting more. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm getting more desperate as time goes on, because it hasn't changed and things aren't changing. It's getting worse.
Would you say that kind of, is that like that delivery and that motivation about getting kind of your message across as important as the music? Like, there's a duality there, or is one more important than the other?
For me, it's dual. And they back me up perfectly with the music. They do really, really, really. It's powerful. It's really powerful tunes they come out with. They don't come out with sort of poppy. We couldn't be a pop punk band, and I don't think any of them could be, even if they weren't in this band. They've got an edge to us that isn't in the pop punk.
Well, so it's
it's just it's not something that we basically, like, I have to be heard, and the songs don't make really much sense unless the vocals sitting on top and it's spitting. It's the sort of band we are. We grew from those roots. We grew from protest punk. We haven't, you know what I mean? We've had no reason to change direction. We've no interest in becoming a sort of rock and roll music business band. We're a protest punk band and always have been. And it's a stepping stone for any member of the band who does want to go on into music and that sort of thing. They can go, because we've an open door policy. We've just, you know, it's... But with the way we are, it's the sort of music, the sound that we're coming from is that protest punk of the sort of start of the 80s when punk went hardcore. Like, a lot of bands, you know, they came from the musical 77 side of it, and which is brilliant. You know, I love all that stuff. I listen to it every day, but the stuff I really got into and the stuff that we formed out of was the when it turned hard in 1980, when all the young bands started getting in. We don't want, you know, no frills. This is punk, angry, noisy, messed up, and we're not now stuck in one thing. We try to make it as interesting and varied, because of the bands I heard in those days, like the Mob. Every band on that Crass record label was different. They all went different ways with it. They all used, very smartly, they used music without making it sort of, what you call it, without making music safe. They did use it. They went very pop, and they were very clever in how they did things. We could still do the same, and we can. We are trying to do it. Our record doesn't sound like any other band, and never will.
I'll probably ask both of you this question, actually, about getting heard by as many people. And Peter said that, you know, obviously the band aren't interested in making money, but putting it all back into the band again. You've had a couple of singles in the charts and stuff, and you do push that as a band. And obviously it's not motivated by a desire to be popular. But, like, do you feel that using iTunes and pushing, say, a cheaper single and stuff so it's heard, is all just down to that kind of genuine desire to want people, to as many people to hear the music as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's not much point in writing a song and recording a song which you're quite proud of and then deliberately making sure no one can hear it. So you make it available. So, yeah,
we're not averse to making music money either. We're not averse to it. It's just that it's very hard to do with the style of music we do. That's why we haven't changed and gone pop punk or followed the latest fashions in punk, because punk is like nearly every form of music. It has its trends and its fashions and its this week's heroes and, you know what I mean? It has all those things. We don't go for that, but we do. When we do a song, we will push it. And if it makes it big, great. If someone takes one of our songs and makes us a million, we'll take it. You know what I mean? We're not averse to it, and we're not searching it. We're not actively seeking it. Like,
I mean, I went out of my way to try to do everything I could to play the game, to be able to hype two singles into the charts. That was the Dead Kennedys in us trying to do that. You know, I mean, Dead Kennedys were a political band who were full of pranks. We're not a million miles from doing that. That was the, you know, it was a scam. It was a scam to show up. It's the industry for the scam that it is, for the whole nonsense that it is, but also to stick yourself there. You know, I've got a kind of perverse sense of humour that I really would love to have been in the boardroom in Universal Music on the morning when they're looking down at all of their X Factor acts in the top 10, and we're stuck right in the middle in between JLS and Take That. I mean, that's just the kind of thing that appeals to my sick sense of humour.
And it's part of the DIY thing as well. We'd like to have control over everything. We don't want no one telling us what to do. Nobody. We like the subversion and fun that's what we got into punk or post-punk, which is basically what we are, because we weren't there in 1977, and we don't try to be any of those bands. We've robbed a few riffs, yes, sure, and
excuse me?
We'll rob a few more.
Excuse me, we haven't robbed any of those riffs, but use them for inspiration.
It's fun and subversion is basically what we're about, and we're having fun, and we're all great mates. We have, like, you know, we go everywhere, and we've gone further than any other Irish band. We're you know what I mean, and we've done it on our own terms. We owe nobody nothing. We've got all our own product. And it's all valid. It's all vital as well if you're into punk. And it's starting to get recognised everywhere now, which makes a huge difference for us.
Yeah, so surely that must be really reassuring to see audiences getting younger and, you know, more people buying your albums and stuff, that by sticking to your guns that you've been proven right.
Yeah.
It's vindication. There's no doubt about that. It's vindication. Everyone who says you should have done it this way, the people who in the early 80s looked down at us because, you know, Virgin Records were interested in signing us and we didn't return the phone call. Island Records were interested in signing us. We wouldn't even entertain taking the phone number off somebody else when they said, please contact them. And other bands kind of were looking and saying, you fucking blew it, lads. Yeah, we didn't. Mm-hmm. We didn't. It wasn't what we were about. It wasn't what we were interested in doing. Do it on our own terms, fine. If we manage to sell 100,000 albums on our own terms, I'd rather do that than sell 10 million on someone else's terms.
And as well, it's kept us part of the scene, because we're now promoting all the new young bands who no one was there to pick us up at the start. There was nobody around to help us get gigs. There was nobody to put us on. There was nobody. Whereas we're turning the whole thing around and we're releasing stuff because no one wanted to hear our demo tapes years ago. Nobody would help us. And we had to go to England and we didn't even get help from there. Eventually we got it. But I mean, and it was really hard, like, coming from here because there was no gigs. So we're coming from that sort of a culture. So now that we have it, you know what I mean? It's great, but we'll use it to keep the scene alive and keep it healthy, because there's a hundred pop punk bands around that are about as valid. You know, They're horrible. But there's loads of them, and there's a culture that could lead you into that field. Punk, dear chap, what's that? You know what I mean? And there's plenty. You know what I mean? We just wanted to keep the scene healthy, alive. We have subversive bands with something to say, bands that could see bigger than their noses, you know what I mean? And I think we've succeeded in that. I'm happy with the way things have gone with the band anyway.
I spoke to Peter about some of the some of the bands that you've put out and some of the bands you plan to put out as well. Obviously, there's probably two questions. One is, they have to commit to the same ideal as you if they're going to be on the label? And secondly, there's a lot of bands, like, even in the Dublin scene, you being selective about who you're going to put on the label, does that create problems, or is it just it's down to your taste, so you never really?
It's probably just it's more down to a sense of timing. To a certain degree, unless a band is into the way that we do things and who we are and how we do it and why we do it, they're not going to be the slightest bit interested in working with us and putting an album out in the first place, right? But also it all comes down to the timing on it. If like Job Seekers wanted to do an album and they were going in to record one and they hadn't actually done anything with it, they hadn't thought about how they were going to do it, well, there's the ideal opportunity. All right, you're going in to do an album, right, we'll put it out for you. And we know it'll be good because they're a really, really good band.
But they're not stuck to us. You know what I mean? Yeah. They can go and take that album, and any of the bands that have put stuff out with us, they can go on. We're not stuck. We're just a vehicle for them to get into the music industry and have their product out there so that people can, if they want to go further, that's their choice. They're not stuck. Well, we don't, you know what I mean? If a band approaches us and if they're good, if we think they're good, great. If we think they're a pile of bollocks, we tell them they're a pile of bollocks. But you know what I mean? We won't stand in their way, you know what I mean? But at the same time, we go, the sort of bands that we push are the ones who aren't the obvious bang, bang, bang. You know, there's plenty of them bands as well.
Yeah.
And the new Liz is Eva album is an absolute stormer, and I must say I'm really pleased that they wanted to do it with us, because
we tend to go for more bands that aren't, you know, what you call post-punk bands. We tend to go for or anarcho punk bands, or you know what I mean. Like there's some brilliant bands in Dublin who wouldn't be on our label, but we play their gigs. We run gigs with Lee Hervey's, Dope Tones. There's all these sort of bands, and they're brilliant bands and brilliant people, but they're not coming from the same stable as us, if you know what I mean. And from the same scene, but they wouldn't be. Their stuff wouldn't look good on it. Well, it wouldn't look, you know, it wouldn't look right on our label.
Except for Lee Harvey's
one, which is coming out.
Well, you know what I mean? But, that's how varied it is. But it's not like that we don't go actively looking for them. But if they come to us and if we can see a band like Setting Off Sirens or whatever bands that we have done, and we put on all those gigs all the time, so we're getting to see all the new bands all the time. So we can tell which ones we're into. And if we can help out any of the bands, great.
And I suppose in a way as well, the kind of the compilation albums and the live albums and stuff, that's a way of being all inclusive, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, that's a way of getting an awful lot of bands out in the one batch. Now I have to say they're a lot more of a headache. It's a lot harder pulling one of those together than it is pulling together a Setting Off Sirens album, because there's too many other people that you're trying to deal with. You quickly learn a couple of the bands that you probably wouldn't deal with. You know, this one of the bands got dropped off one of the live albums because they started pissing and moaning about wanting to be selective and mix the track themselves. Crap. If you must take off and do it yourself, it's not going on this album.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to have someone engineering it that they're going to sound a hell of a lot better than everybody else. So, but, yeah, I mean, the compilation albums, you know, we've just done a one for Hot Press.
They just approach you to...
No, we approach them.
All right, okay.
I approach them on the street.
Fair enough.
I am Maureen, the production editor. Okay. I met her on the street and had a go at her about the lack of support of the underground music. I had a casual go. It wasn't me. It was me saying, you know, you're losing ground with the underground music scene and the people who are into it, and it's a massive rising thing, and you're totally not there, because no one's reviewing it, no one's tackling it, no one's writing about it. I want to put together a compilation album stamped by us of all of the best bands that are around at the moment. Why don't we do that and put it out as a free download to Hot Press?
And when are they doing it?
It's imminent.
All right, okay.
It's imminent. That things sometimes work slowly in Hot Press land.
Okay.
But it's if it's not the next issue, it'll probably be in the one after that.
And it's going to be a download as opposed to a
download only, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It's too expensive to do a CD. You wouldn't get anyone. As they said, I mean, I spoke with Niall Stokes about it directly as well, and he was saying, look, with the best will in the world, the only way that you can put a CD as a cover mount is to have somebody sponsoring it. And he said the chances of Coors Light wanting to be the sponsor of the 12 best punk rock bands in Ireland CD is pretty minimal.
Dutch Gold,
but you see, Dutch Gold might want to push their trying to take their drink out of the gutter rather than ensconce it in there. So We went with the idea of the download, which is actually, I think, is a great idea in that it's being done so that you can't go online and go, yeah, I have the Job Seekers track. Fuck the rest of them. You take them all. Mm-hmm. You know, you take them all. That's all or nothing.
If you know them well enough to go up in the street and you know talk about this kind of stuff, what is the reasoning behind not giving the scene coverage? Because you've always seemed to have friends in operas. Like even all the albums get reviewed and new sections and stuff like that.
It's a thing which I've said to a few bands in the past who've actually been critical of the fact that operas don't put them in. They don't show players the gig and review them. The sad thing is, you know, in the world of publishing, there's less resources available. And so the music industry has kind of turned from, say, in the 70s maybe, you know, in the early 70s or whatever else, they were actively trying to find bands to write about and they were going looking for bands and blah, blah, blah. Now they don't need to do that because all the bigger bands have got a publicist. So there's a one source, there's a one point of call that they don't even go to. They get a phone call off, you know, Dan Ogley or somebody like that, picking up the phone and saying, right, this is who we've got this week. You know, the minutes, they're really happening, and blah, blah, blah. And they list all these things, they send them in beautifully, well-written, concise press releases to do with something. And the simplest job in the world now for a journalist is to cut, paste, stick it in, there's your photograph. Here's my full page done.
Yeah, but the last time Hot Press was relevant was when? 1978?
78.
I mean, they've never actually, after U2, they didn't have to go looking. There was nothing. Anyway, the Irish music scene that they promote in that, you know what I mean? They're old men. They're dead. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know what's happening with the kids. And they view funk as something that happened in the 70s. They don't actually realise that it's modern and it's now what kids are getting into again.
Well, I think it's not,
it doesn't even
now.
Sound the same. They've always had a problem with punk anyway. They've always, they always thought, wow, we had the nice safe radiators. You know, these weren't punks. They were playing punk music. They couldn't handle the pistols. They couldn't handle, you know what I mean? They couldn't handle the real thing. And then when punk hardened in 81, they ran like fuck. They ran away from it, like when the bands like Napalm Sunday and Us and the Pretty started appearing around town. They ran. They couldn't go near it. And they still haven't changed. Mm. Basically, they're nothing to do with music. They're just an entertainment magazine. Yeah. They're nothing to do with music anymore.
They have a begrudging but huge respect for what we do at this stage of the game.
Yeah.
Well, they'd want to have after it took us 7 years to get into the fucking thing.
Yeah.
When I was 14, I was in a Pixie cover band called Subculture, which was amazing because I was 14. And my mum and dad let me out to play gigs and take the day off school the next day because my dad's in a band all of his life. And that was the first band I ever joined. This is the second one. It's by chance, by the way Peter is saying. But Deco was in the pub in the Foggy Dew one night, and we had a chat about how much I could maybe benefit the band as much to Peter's disbelief. But I know Peter and Deco and all that since I'm like 12, 13, hanging around the streets of Dublin, and went to see them play a lot of times, refused to pay in, so on the guest list or I'm not going kind of thing. And Deco invited me to record Treasure on the Wasteland, which I couldn't make because I was sick, and he still refuses to believe to this day that that's what happened. But so eventually I got to go get another chance in the recording studio, and I did that, and it went out really, really well.
I just had to add that little piece of Aoife there at the end. Aoife spoke to me for a couple of minutes more than that, and also so did Paul. And but as you can hear at the very end of that piece, that was when my Marantz, my little portable recorder, died. It's since been fixed, but I lost about 3 or 4 minutes of audio. But yeah, Aoife spoke some more, but I'll just have to catch her again. That, of course, was Aoife singing there, doing a fantastic version of Penetration's Don't Dictate, the second of the tracks that they recorded especially for the show, and which will be available as B-sides on the new single Pulls Apart, which is released next weekend. Okay, really tied for time here at the moment now, so just going to try get in this last little bit of the interview. The last question I put to Deco was, did he think that this kind of renewed interest in punk had anything to do with maybe the social climate in Ireland being quite similar to the early 80s when Paranoid Visions originally formed?
Well as the fact that Green Day and all those bands were huge a couple of years ago, and they had a huge impact in getting young people into. Now, we couldn't see punk bands when they were around the first time. You couldn't see them. There was no gigs. It wasn't on television. You had to go to England. So basically, they've seen, and there's all, even the pop thing, that all gets people into. So they dig and they dig. And kids are getting into protest because that's all you've got. That's the only voice you've got at the moment. And it's coming, it's not just punk, it's coming in hip-hop. You've seen Temperamental, Miscellaneous and all these, it's coming on the hip-hop scene. It's protest music and it's starting, you know, kids are getting into it. And then when you get into it, you start seeing other directions. There's bands like I Am a Car Crash, This Is Evil. They're not punk bands, but they're coming out of that whole, that angry, edgy music. And that's what punk is. And it's, if you want to stick a, you know, if you want something to say, well, get a band and say it. But I mean, it's happening. It's happening everywhere. It's getting there. And it's not, I don't think it should be called punk, because I think punk is dead. I think it has been for a long, long time. But it is. It's what the ordinary person on the street, when they hear that music, they're going to say, that's punk rock. Basically, nowadays, it's an amalgamation of everything stripped down. And that's, if that's punk, well then it's great.
And that brings us to the end of our interview of Paranoid Visions. There was plenty more, and I might add a little bit to the podcast, which I'll post up on the Near FM website tomorrow. Also, on the Mixcloud version of the show, we'll be able to include the music. Now, we won't be able to do that on the podcast, as it's Imra doesn't allow it. But we will post up the full show on Mixcloud, including all the music. Just a couple of things before we go. The EP launch is going to be, the EP launch is doubling up as a Rebellion warm-up, and that's in Fibber McGee's next weekend, and features Dubtones, Liz Is Evil, and Loaded 44. And then Loaded 44 play a free gig in Sweeney's the following night on the Saturday. And of course, that means that the EP launch is on Friday. Okay, one more thing. Just a shout out to Brian Green, and they're organising a radioactive reunion, and that's at the, it's at the Dark Horse Inn. And he informs me that Deco used to be a DJ on the station, and that Deco is going to be doing a DJ set also next Saturday on the 21st of July. Okay, so yeah, podcast goes up tomorrow, Mixcloud probably tomorrow as well. And then this song, it goes, a song that we spoke about earlier on in the interview, and this was by request for Paul. This is their cover of the Atrix's Treasure on the Wasteland. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week with an interview from Niall Quinn, formerly of The Hitchers and The Penny Whores, now releasing stuff under the guise of Team Tune Boy. So that's here next Friday night. Okay, thanks for listening, and talk to you then.